Hello, hello. We're back again. Good morning and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, where we talk about music, film, TV and anything else that crosses our peripheral vision. We try to find out what's worth bothering about. My name's Andrew Harrison, and in a packed programme this week, it's 50 years, more or less, to the week when the Bee Gees recorded their very first British single, New York Mining Disaster, 1941. We'll be talking about the Gibb Brothers' arc from Australian pop transportees to unfairly mocked balladeers and disco merchants to their current status as critical favourites. Why did people find this fantastic group so amusing? And are they, in fact, the best Manchester band ever? We'll also be looking at the latest addition to the Marvel series of superhero adaptations on Netflix. Iron Fist is kung fu action set in New York. Is it up there with previous Netflix shows like Jessica Jones and Daredevil? Can Marvel sustain its winning streak? In addition, we'll be looking at new music from Spoon and Anoni, the artist formerly known as Anthony of the Johnsons. And of course, we'll be hearing some of our guests' favourite songs at the moment. So let's say hello to those guests. Making his Big Mouth debut is the writer and broadcaster Peter Perfides. A long-time writer for Mojo and The Guardian, he also presents his own show on Soho Radio. He writes about music without the irksome interference of deadlines and editors on the Hidden Tracks website. And recently, he appeared on Radio 4's A Good Read, where he got Harriet Harman to read Julian Cope's Head On. And she got him to read We Need to Talk About Kevin. Hello, Peter. Welcome to
Good Morning.
Listeners can hear the A Good Read on the iPlayer, but how was Harriet Harman to deal with? How did she get him to read Julian Cope?
Well, I mean, I felt a bit guilty, sort of. But then, you know, that's the format of the thing, isn't it? You know, whatever. It's like the one bit, probably the most powerful I've felt in years, actually, that I actually I get to force Harriet Harman to read Julian Cope's memoir. So, you know, I couldn't not do it. There were kind of other possibly worthier or more kind of predictable things that one could have chosen. But it was the great thing about it is that you kind of turn up to the studio and you're sort of banned from talking to the other guests about what you thought about the book. So until the red light went on, I didn't know what Harriet thought about it. And so if you listen back, you probably hear the kind of slight shock in my voice when she the gasp when she said, "I loved it." And it was really great as well, because the presenter, who's called Harriet Gilbert, really didn't like it and didn't really get it very much. Mm. So it was just a fantastic surprise.
Also with us is Michael Hann, music editor of The Guardian, who is my favourite editor this week because he let me file a feature a whole 2 weeks late, which is very kind of him. Michael has a terrible weakness for soft rock and heavy metal, but we don't hold that against him. He handles the relentless Guardian music blog, which eats material and must be fed every day. Amongst the up-and-coming young acts he's spoken to this year are young singer-songwriter Bruce Springsteen and Spoon, who we'll be talking about later. Hello, Michael. How are you?
Hello, Andrew. I'm very well, thank you.
So you did Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce Springsteen was quite a while ago, actually. It was in October. I had an amazing. I've been on this show since then.
Ah.
But it was an amazing week. I had a long interview with REM and a long interview with Bruce Springsteen, published in the same week. And after that, fundamentally, there was nothing left for me in life.
Also with us, you just heard him then, as ever, maintaining a full frequency response of rattling sub bass right the way up to sounds only dogs and bats can hear. It is our producer, the one-man BBC Radiophonic Workshop of podcast, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Who's the biggest hero you've met through the business then?
I met Bruce
a couple of years ago.
Springsteen, yes. Yeah. Well, you have this after-gig thing, which is quite interesting. We're staying at Claridge's, and each of the band has a really big table in the kind of dining room at Claridge's where they can invite their guests and sit down. And then the hoi polloi have to kind of wait outside for the kind of royal visit, which was the strata that I was on. But I met Alex Ferguson. But the only person I've met who I had my photograph taken, because I always think it's quite highly unprofessional at the end of an interview to kind of like go, and it's a job and they're doing a job and whatever, is Big Gip from the Goody Mob.
Big Gip from the Goody Mob.
I was most excited. Yeah.
I'm sure you personally were most excited. I don't think I could pick out Big. Big Gip is the Chinese supermarket around that way.
The only photo I've ever done was with AC/DC after I interviewed them.
Yeah.
Powerage was the first album I ever bought. And yeah, that was big for me. Mm-hmm. Unlike AC/DC, who were very much not big. And Angus Young's wife made Angus stand on a chair next to me, because it was the only way he wouldn't be coming up to somewhere near my waist.
Oh, that would be great.
Fantastic. Do you feel the same about autographs? Do you sort of I hold back on autographs unless it's somebody like a hero. Yeah. I've only ever done it about four times.
I get things signed for people.
Yeah.
If somebody asks me to, can't remember who it was that my daughter asked for an autograph. So I got, you know, I got an autograph for her.
Yeah.
Okay, shall we crack on? Let's get started. As I mentioned, it's 50 years since the Bee Gees recorded their earliest British music. Our guest Pete Perfidius was especially keen to talk about them this week, and who are we to deny him? Much sniffed at by the kind of critics who like to sniff at things, the Bee Gees were, of course, not just absurdly prosperous hitmakers in their own right, but also songwriters for countless hits for others. If I Can't Have You by Yvonne Elliman, Islands in the Stream by Dolly Parton and Kenny Rogers, and, of course, Diana Ross's Chain Reaction. And yet they still don't quite get their due. We will ponder this injustice after we have a listen to this from the very earliest days, written by Barry and Robin Gibb from their debut back in 1967. This is To Love Somebody. Bee Gees and To Love Somebody from The Bee Gees First from 1967. It is an occupational hazard of being a Bee Gees song that you get slaughtered by cover versions by Westlife and Boyzone, isn't it?
It's the price you have to pay. I mean, these songs immediately became standards and, you know, for the Gibb brothers, these melodies, these exquisitely melancholy melodies, they just seem to have located this source of low-hanging melodic fruit that no one had discovered at that point, because just the hit rate, the strike rate in those early people, obviously because of the post Saturday Night Fever years, people don't forget those early years. I don't think people really stopped to consider just how many amazing songs there were and how they hit the ground running. I mean, so 50 years ago, they finished work on the first batch of songs that would end up on their first album after they got off the ship from Australia. And I love that first album. That Bee Gees, it's called Bee Gees First, although it was actually their third because they made a couple in Australia. And it's kind of underrated as well, because you can never really say they're ahead of their time, but they're very quick assimilators. So whatever was kind of going on around them, they could sort of take it on board very quickly. And that album, what I love about that album is it just sounds like all of 1967 all at once. So you've got a bit of you've got obviously a lot of Beatles in there, and you've got a bit of sort of that. You got a lot of that kind of almost slightly music hall kind of military pomp influenced psychedelia coming in. There's a lot of stuff that sounds like the Zombies. I think it might have predated the Zombies, and the Odyssey and Oracle at any rate. And they're just God knows what happened to them in their childhood, but. Bloody hell, to me,
it's like the cusp of showbiz and actual orchestral rock music. It's kind of, there's something about it. They still got that doing the clubs, close harmony thing.
What you're saying about assimilation is really interesting, because I was listening to it and I was thinking the only artist comparable of that time that did that kind of thing with harmonies was the Hollies, who of course came from Manchester. And is there a thing about the Bee Gees seeing what the Hollies were doing with close harmonies on those kind of early singles and going, I don't know, I haven't heard any of the Australian stuff, so I don't know if they were doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that ultra-melodic kind of punchy sort of pop thing. And but there are also things like the Moody Blues coming through, so you had that kind of dreamy kind of slightly lysergic thing. But even when they were lysergic, they were too sort of enthralled to melody.
I've just come up with this theory.
So work with me. On this one.
Stuff, yeah.
Which is that the Kenny Everett video show was the most influential arbiter of taste.
Totally.
And turned people into objects of mockery, people who should have been taken seriously. It happened to the Bee Gees with the Massachusetts sketch. Happened to Rod Stewart with the expanding bum sketch.
Yes.
And so Kenny Everett set to a generation. You know, the set of attitudes that led eventually to Clive Anderson interviewing the Bee Gees saying, is there no beginning to your talents?
Yeah. There are two things going on here. I think Kenny Everett's sort of piss take was, there was a kind of affection, I think, in Kenny Everett. When you look at it now, and I don't really...
But when you're watching that when you're 10 or 11, you're not thinking...
No.
There is affection here for the early psychedelic pop recordings. You go, ha ha!
And also, not willing to speak ill of the dead, but he wasn't the most subtle of comedians, was it? You know, the Let's Bomb Russia. It might have been a cutting satire.
That was why he was great, though. I mean, we love Ken,
That, the Rod Stewart thing is just still kind of, it kills me. Anyway, but I think there are two things that go. The more pernicious thing was that, which, as you say, you mentioned the Clive Anderson thing. I think they were absolutely right to walk out of that interview. There was nothing kind of, that Clive Anderson thing was the culmination of a slightly sneering kind of Oxbridge kind of maybe. More, we like, you know, we kind of really love prog rock, but we kind of look down on anything that's a bit pop.
But also people who don't actually understand pop music.
Oh, totally, totally.
Yeah. Well, also they kind of knee-jerk rejection of anything disco, which of course,
yeah, all of that
entire disco period is
all
now
of that
one
fed
of the wonders
into that
of Western
interview.
Civilization.
Yeah, all of that fed into that interview. And of course, you know, lest we forget, Clive Anderson was mates with Angus Deaton, who did the
heebie-jeebies
thing,
yes.
With meaningless songs in very high voices, which, you know... Not, I don't think that's kind of the high watermark of comedy, I have to say. So I don't blame them. I admired them for walking out. Robin Gibb would walk out of an interview that I did with him.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you pull a Clive Anderson, or were you too nice?
No, the odd thing was, this was for a radio documentary I made about Robin Gibb's lost album, Sing Slowly Sisters. And we, after much sort of diplomacy and persuasion, we were, myself and the producer of the programme, invited over to his house in Oxfordshire. And I was actually trying to, the question that made him tell me to fuck off and walk out was that I said, you know, look, I don't understand, you know, in the rush to venerate your 70s work, people forget what a brilliant band you were in the 60s. And he thought I was doing down their disco kind of, I mean, if I'd said disco, he would have walked out. But, and then he sort of walked out, he said, I've had enough. And he walked down the hall. And as I pleaded to get him to come back, he just shouted, fuck off. And so I had to let myself out of his house. he rescheduled the interview. He apologised much later, and he rescheduled the interview in London. So it all ended well.
Mm. Do you think, I mean, Michael, you said that you sort of rightly took issue with the idea that the critics don't like the Bee Gees, because it was the critics of the 70s and the 80s who were sneering about them. Now, the generation of critics around this table love them and remember them from when we were kids, but also have rediscovered the orchestral, the baroque stuff, which is effectively like the nuggets of Bee Gees. Do you think it's because there aren't those 5,000 word features about the Bee Gees, people like us can love them because we don't have to do any work on them? We don't have to sit there ploughing through to write 20,000 words for Uncut or Mojo. This is like we can enjoy music the way we used to before we had to trowel through it.
No, I just think it's to do with generational taste changing and people. I mean, it's, I don't think it's a kind of kill your father's attitude or anything. I just think it's that every generation has different prejudices, and this generation doesn't have the prejudice against the Bee Gees. I'm sure we have prejudices that another generation on will go, oh my God, those people.
How could they be so mean about Ed Sheeran?
But you see it all the time. For instance, when I was a kid reading the music press, AC/DC were sneered upon. Except in Kerrang, AC/DC was sneered at. Now you can't pick up a title that doesn't assume that. It doesn't work on the assumption that AC/DC are one of the greatest rock and roll bands ever.
Pete, will you do us a favour? Will you make us, and Michael, you can help with this, will you make us a very short and concise Spotify Bee Gees nuggets?
I already have.
Stuff? Oh, all right, fantastic. Well,
I've made a Spotify playlist last year called The Indisputable Godlike Genius of the Bee Gees.
Right.
But it's 40 songs long, but it'll fly by.
Okay. We'll stick it up on the Facebook page. Okay, so evidently it's requests week on Big Mouth. I asked Pete what he wanted to talk about, and he said the Bee Gees. And we asked Michael Hann what he wanted to talk about, and he said Spoon. He interviewed the Austin, Texas band for The Guardian last week, and the first line was, the first group Brit Daniel loved was the Bee Gees, so it's all getting circular. Spoon are about to release their 9th album, Hot Thoughts, and it's safe to say that they're a bit of an unknown quantity to a lot of British listeners. We'll be setting that straight after we have a quick listen to this taster. Open wide, this is Spoon with Can I Sit Next to You?
Can I sit next to you? Can you sit next to me? Get the stars out your eyes.
That was Spoon with Can I Sit Next to You. Michael Hann, has anything amusing ever happened to you in connection with the Spoon? Me and my Spoon. Tell us why you love them.
Spoon actually predate me writing about music or doing anything to do with music for a living. They're a group I first heard on a Matador compilation that I picked up on holiday, a track called Don't Buy the Realistic, which is from their debut album Telefono. And since then, I have gone out and bought everything they've done. They're a curious group. In that they're now quite big news in America. The last two albums have been top five in America, and yet they are, I wouldn't say nothing over here, but they're not a group that anyone knows. When I sent out my interview on Twitter, two people responded saying, I am the only person in Britain who loves Spoon. And some, no, I'm the only person who loves Britain and Spoon. But they're people of an interesting range. One of those two people was the dance DJ and producer Ewan Pearson.
Oh, right.
The other was MJ out of Hookworms. So they kind of they span the range.
There's a Venn diagram I didn't expect to see.
A collab I don't want to hear, yeah.
they span the range from, you know, proper indie noisenics through to people who are very interested in sonics. And I think that that's what's fascinating about Spoon. The fact that they are absolutely obsessed with how records sound, but also obsessed with the song. And there aren't actually that many groups who are that fascinated by both. The old John Peel line about The Fall, always different, always the same, applies to Spoon, because every record does sound different to the one before, and yet is always recognisably the work of the same band.
Well, it struck me as, I mean, this is repeating a Big Mouth theme of albums I really wasn't expecting to enjoy and ended up really enjoying. I mean, they struck me as being quite European, actually, because
yeah.
that making a capital R record thing is not what American rock bands do. In fact, they tend to revel in, you know, hey, we did this with, you know, authentic hand-sourced electricity in Steve Albini's bin. You know, it's kind of keeping it lo-fi. And this is a very sculpted thing that feels kind of quite British. Pete, what did you think of it?
I really liked it. And, you know, and I sort of burrowed into their back catalogue and sort of discovered some more stuff. I can see also, though, why they're a band that doesn't get written about too much, because they don't... It's hard to sort of... You know, there's some bands are as much an idea as they are a band, and they don't sort of... It's hard to sort of burrow into kind of what they sort of stand for as such. They stand for just making kind of records that are just very sort of pleasing to listen to. The dynamics are really fantastic. They're incredibly sort of hooky. And so I can see why people who love them really, really love them, because, you know, they're not... They're not really very well represented, sort of, in terms of, you know, column inches or whatever. So,
well, there isn't really a massive story. There isn't.
There
nobody's,
isn't
a, nobody's murdered anybody.
That was the problem when I went to write about them. What did I actually say? Look, every piece about you just talks about the music. Is that because you're only interested in talking about the music, or is it because you've literally never done anything interesting? Mm. Well, they kind of laughed. But basically, that is the point. They're not concerned about portraying a story in them. At one level, as a listener, you think, how refreshing. It's all about the music. But as a journalist, you think, oh, come on, do something. Because I really want to champion you.
A lot of you must have struggled with being gay or anything.
It so felt odd, nine albums into a group's career, to be writing a feature that's fundamentally, here is this group and here is their past, which you don't normally do at that point. You're normally trying to find some exciting new development. But I don't know. Britt Daniel, isn't what you say about them being a very European group is absolutely true. And Britt Daniel is a massive, you know, Anglophile, New Wave obsessive. Wire were his favourite group when he was a kid. And you can always hear Wire throughout their records, especially in the stripping down of everything.
Yeah,
they are always about removing elements from song. They're never about adding things in. But he says it remains slightly baffling as to why no one in Europe likes them, since they are so plainly European. Yeah. It might help if they actually came over here more often, I think. Mm.
Okay, well, let's clash the gears a little bit and listen to somebody who does have an enormous story. Anoni, formerly Anthony of Anthony and the Johnsons. She has a new EP out called Paradise, a companion piece to the album Hopelessness. The Paradise EP seeks to support activist conversations and disrupt assumptions about popular music through the collision of electronic sound and highly politicised lyrics, it says here. So before we get into that, let's have a quick listen. This is Anoni and the title track from Paradise. Noni and Paradise from Air, Paradise EP. Pete Path, what did you make of this?
I mean, it's in my younger days, when I was a much younger music writer than I am now. It's probably something that I might have just kind of been positive about, because you can't sort of fault it as such. It's kind of heavy on ideas. There's a kind of sonic integrity to it. But actually, that I've given enough of those records good reviews and subsequently never listened to them again to sort of to be a bit more kind of realistic about the role that they sort of have in your life. And this is Anoni's this seems to be an EP that kind of addresses a lot of the discord that's happening in the world at the moment. So its intentions are very noble. It's, I think the press release talks about a statement where Annone hits out at Trump's presidency. As if he gives a shit.
you say that.
If you're Snoop Dogg, it might be. If she, please edit that.
Well, I want to talk about Snoop Dogg. That's my closing time chatter, so yeah. Let's hold that thought.
Okay. If she was Snoop Dogg, it might make a difference. A mutual acquaintance of many of ours here, I think, were Nick Dewey, came up with this term called innocent pain, which is the opposite of guilty pleasures, which are these kind of critically bulletproof artists who make records that are frequently an ordeal to listen to. And yeah. I think this is a perfect opportunity to hang that on.
With tracks like Jesus Will Kill You and lyrics saying, I never feel part of this world, I reject the way we live, I give birth to my enemy, you kind of think, well, at a logical, argumentative level, I fully support you in your struggle. Good luck to you, and I'm glad there's somebody like you around. But it is fiendishly hard work, isn't it, Michael?
Well, Jesus Will Kill You, I haven't even picked the most smack you around the head lyrics from there. I particularly enjoyed, from Jesus Will Kill You, you're a mean old man. What's your legacy? Burning fields in Iraq, burning fields in Nigeria, burning oceans, burning populations. It's kind of
the man is a bad guy, isn't he? The man. He's terrible.
I'm not sure which particular. I think that's probably just the military-industrial complex. It's in whole. Yeah. I have a theory as to why artists like Annone get amazing reviews, and like Pete, I feel clearly there is worthwhile stuff here. There aren't enough hours in the day for me to want to engage with it on a personal level. And my theory is that it's true of films as well. That film critics and music critics wade through so much that is mediocre and identikit. That when something that just seems different comes along, oh my God, this sounds different, it must be amazing, and therefore it gets the 4 and 5 star reviews. Mm. And I understand the impulse completely. But
if these lyrics were attached to something that sounded like the new Katy Perry single, they would do far much more, sort of, they would get closer to achieving.
Well, I think that's it. Effect. I think that, you know, actually some of the tracks on this EP, I think Ricochet, because Hudson Mohawk's produced some of it, and I think that the tracks that are kind of, you know, what we term as bangers now, actually work a lot better because they've got a propulsive kind of something interesting and kind of driving going on, and the juxtaposition of miserable, lighten up a bit, mate, thing on stuff on top, it works really well. And it's kind of like the stuff that she did with Hercules and Love Affair, when it was kind of like classic, kind of deep New York house.
That was brilliant.
With you know, and that I still think, you know, is regarded by many as the high point of her career, and it's kind of
Well, the grain of her voice is amazing. It's instantly recognisable. It's expressive. It's powerful. It's both kind of deeply serious and yet can articulate a lot of joy. And when it's plugged into Hercules and Love Affair's disco, essentially, I sort of feel it does more to bring people together.
But also
than
on
this
that
hectoring stuff.
But also on that Ricochet track, she sings kind of two lines against each other, and the one line is singing the kind of the chorus line, which is very antithesis of what her usual style is, and then putting the other style, the regular style, on top of it, I think works really well, and it's kind of that was the standout track for me.
It's about the difference between pop music and art, isn't it? And Annone very definitely thinks that she is making art, and I think certainly this morning, at least, we're all in the mood for pop music.
I'm in the mood for dancing. Romancing, in fact, at all times. it just felt a little bit eat your greens to me, this record. I mean, good luck to her. We all need to eat our greens, but I think Pete's right. You wouldn't necessarily reach for this in a moment of extremis and go, let's get the party started. Okay, let's move on to another editor's recommendation. Peter Perfides, what song have you brought in for us?
It's a song called Mother by a new band from Bristol called Idles. That's IDLES. There aren't many sort of guitar-based bands coming through, and the ones that do can sound a little bit sort of tame to me. They're not bands that, you know, certainly as a younger man, I could have got really excited about. And even now, you know, so I heard this track, which was actually recommended to me by Felix White from the Maccabees, who's kind of doing these club nights in Bermondsey called Yalla. And I think Idles are one of the bands he's been trying to get to come down and play. And this song is extraordinary. I don't quite know how to completely make sense of it, but it's called Mother. It has this kind of relentless kind of primal sort of kind of energy about it. I think it's kind of, in some places, I think it's kind of a working class empowerment song. I think there's this line that kind of jumps out, which is, the best way to scare a Tory is to read and get rich, which is repeated quite a lot. I guess that's the hook. And then, but then there's another hook, which is motherfucker, and which I thought was motherfucker, but it's motherfucker. And apparently the lead
big difference there.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, but the lead singer,
I'm glad that we're not going out on kind of like, you know, FM radio.
I heard that the front man's mother died a couple of years ago, so I think it might be a sort of a grief record as well. And put it all together, it's kind of pressure cooker thing happens, and their album came out this week, which I've also been listening to. It's also fantastic. Again, there's a bit of a kind of post Sleaford Mods element to some of the lyrics. There's this great song called "Well Done," which has got this kind of motif going all the way through it, which is, why don't you get a job? Even Tarquin has a job. So, and then, why don't you get a medal? Even Tarquin's got a medal. Mary Berry's got a medal. And then, why don't you love football? Trevor Nelson loves football. So why don't you love football? It's amazing.
Okay, well, let's have a listen. This is Idols with Mother. That was Idols with Mother, as chosen by Peter Perfides, who revealed while it was playing that one of them is a dentist. Dentists in rock and roll, send us your emails. Should we talk about TV then? Arriving on Netflix this weekend is the long-awaited Marvel adaptation Iron Fist. The final member of the Defenders super team that's planned for later this year, a kind of lo-fi artisan Avengers. The show concerns orphan New Yorker Danny Rand and how he develops the ancient martial arts skills of the Iron Fist. Will he measure up to guilt-ridden blind Catholic lawyer Daredevil, heavy drinking abuse survivor Jessica Jones, or Black Lives Matter hero Luke Cage? Here is a taste of Iron Fist.
Danny Rand. I've been away a long time.
Let's go. You don't belong here.
I'm Danny Rand. Guys, I just want to talk. Hey! Welcome to Rand Enterprises. I left here 10 years old in a jet with my parents. I became the lone survivor.
Danny Rand, back from the dead. Why has he waited this long to show up? How the hell did he learn martial arts?
Where'd you train?
Kunlun. My father instilled in me a love and respect for this company that has never faded. This is my home.
Rand is my company.
This city is no place for Danny Rand.
We put in practice and discipline. No giving up, no giving in.
Danny, what happened to you? Why are you really back here?
Some bad people have gotten on the inside. Criminals.
I know what they are, what they can do. To fight them, we need someone with special skills.
I've been training my whole life for this. This is my destiny.
A bit of Netflix's Iron Fist there, the latest Marvel adaptation on their street-level superhero genre. We're going to come to Michael Hann and Peter Perfides in a minute, but if you're an overgrown child man like me and Matt Hall, this is terribly exciting. Matt, what did you make of it?
I liked it. Mm-hmm. I thought I've only watched the first two episodes. It's got that kind of Marvel Netflix adaptation slow burn going on, where the first couple of episodes may not, before they get into the proper kind of kick-ass discovering powers superhero stuff, at the end of the second episode. Spoiler alert, he kind of does the Iron Fist, and that's quite exciting. I thought that it fitted quite well into the TV bit of the Marvel Universe.
The setup is a young fella has returned to New York from years in exile in the Mystic East, where he's learned the martial arts, and the company that his father owns is now owned by bad people. And my concern with this is there's never been a time in my entire life when I've been less interested in billionaires tussling over the ownership of corporations.
But that is a standard comic book trope, if you like, whether yeah, it's true. Kinda, you know,
well, that is also why, not just because the world is now run by horrible billionaires, but because I've actually seen it already.
Surely that makes it more real.
No, it just I thought that the bad guy's son, American Psycho, and his sister were crushingly dull. And my problem with it.
Don't you mean Ivanka and Donald Jr.?
Yeah, I don't want to see a superhero drama featuring Ivanka and Donald Jr. unless something interesting is going to happen. I felt it was flat and it was slow. And Michael Hann, I think you kind of concur a bit, don't you?
I thought it was an appalling piece of crap. I'm passing trade for this stuff. You lot are core market. I'm passing trade, and sometimes I'm really grabbed. Jessica Jones, I thought was fantastic. Loved every minute of that. Not so keen on the Marvel movies. I find them a bit too much whiz-bang and not enough actual plot. But let's put that to one side. What this was a 30-year-old version of all that that had only been cursorily updated. It looked cheap. You know, the scenes set
the
in the Himalayas.
Snow
yeah, actual polystyrene snow. And you can see it's polystyrene snow. You can see the cheapness of the matte backdrop. I mean, it's just terrible. The performances are flat and leaden. I have no interest. I mean, Danny Rand, mate, stay homeless. Honestly, it'll be more interesting than the rest of it. The script is terrible. Yeah, everything. It reminds me of, I don't know, Lois and Clark or something. It's just a different generation of superhero show that has not worked, translated to the new generation. Nothing actually happens either. I've actually looked to see future plots, and some of the reviews complain that quite a lot of time is spent on whether Danny Rand can adapt to life in the boardroom. Oh, what a great plot for an action superhero show.
I mean, that's a great plot if you're watching Billions or you're watching some corporate kind of conflict thing. I mean, my issue, I think you hit the nail on the head there. This is always going to be stood in comparison to Daredevil, Jessica Jones and Luke Cage. Jessica Jones has a fantastic starring character, Kirsten Ritter, as this damaged but like heavily ironic and humorous character who gets through her knackered world with humour, and he's got an incredible villain in David Tennant.
It has the best villain ever, and this doesn't appear to have a villain yet, because clearly the billionaire kids are actually not going to be the main villain.
Well, let's hope not.
Because we keep getting set up for The Hand.
Let's hope not, yeah. Daredevil itself has the remarkably, terrifying Kingpin, played by Vincent D'Onofrio, who is one of TV's great psychopaths. And, you know, a fantastic lead role. And just this has just got a bunch of people who say things like, you can't say that, and who sent you, and I'm not going to throw away my life like you. You know, just a string of TV cliches. I think it's certainly the weakest of the Netflix adaptations. Pete Perfides, you're kind of unconvinced in this world of comic books as well, aren't you? What do you think of it?
So it's a bit boring, really. Mm. Not very much happened in over a long space of time. And you know, I didn't. The main guy. Should I know who the main guy is?
He's in Game of Thrones. He's Loras in Game of Thrones.
Good spot.
It's a bit wooden. I thought. You know, there was just. I didn't really care about what happened to him. I didn't really care whether or not they. You know, he's estranged. What are they?
There is his father's business partner's children who he grew up with.
See, I'm already bored.
Yeah.
I didn't.
Were they not related? I thought they were related.
Well, they're childhood friends. I mean,
they're not friends.
They were friends. American Psycho and his sister and Danny Rand, when they were kids, were all family chumps, weren't they? This is the families grew up together.
I also get hung up on the tedious logistics of it all, like him in his kind of Afghan, you know, him in his hippie garb wandering around. Homeless. I'm all the time I was thinking, he must stink. And when the thought, he must stink, is overriding anything to do with the plot.
Well, I really liked the fantastic product placement of the original iPod, which was so kind of obviously so well built and robust that it went through a plane crash in the Himalayas, 15 years in a mystical monastery. And that, yeah, it's still able to play Outcast tracks when he's walking through New York.
Yeah, that one. Yeah, that also reminded me when he pulled out his iPod. Then the homeless guy, who was the fellow hobo guy, who was sitting next to him beneath a tree, showed him the iPhone, the state of the art iPhone he had, and started to tell him what it can do, as if he knew that this guy hadn't seen an iPhone for 15 years.
Yeah.
And that wasn't explained. Well, how did you intuit that this guy doesn't know what
you're
doing?
But we were saying that wouldn't it be the best superhero talent of all to be able to recharge electrical items.
Well, that's the thing with the iPhone. He's got this iPhone. He has no access to electricity. He doesn't have any cables. How is he charging his iPhone?
I think it's the power of chi in the city of Kunlun can charge iPods, even old ones with the old USB that you can't get anymore. I mean, I think Pete really put his finger on it there, which is this is a story that is driven by tedious plot necessity rather than by the characters. And in all of the other adaptations, even Luke Cage, which has kind of lost its way a little bit, they're all driven by fascinating central characters. The hero and the villain are all people that you can understand and you can, to some extent, root for. Even, you know, you can even root for the Kingpin in Daredevil because you can see he has a view on the world and he has a certain nobility. Everybody in this is a cardboard cutout. And to me, it is the most disappointing of the Netflix adaptations.
Well, is that Netflix and Marvel being really clever? They're putting together the Defenders supergroup and they're fully aware that everybody has a favourite member of a kind of superhero team and the least favourite member. So they've kind of gone...
They're concentrating all the least favourite energy on one character.
But I loved...
And he's also last. He's also the last one revealed.
I loved Iron Fist in the comics. I still love him now because they've taken that character and they've iterated him so many times. They've given him a mystical past and they've given him a duty. When it started out, it was just a guy who did Kung Fu. He'd learned Kung Fu in a mystical city, but as time's gone by, they've put him in a lineage of, you know, this is a mantle that he must carry. He has a duty towards this discipline, and that's interesting. It's all very, you know, Sun Tzu and Orientalist.
The single good bit in the first two episodes is where the Doctor has. Everyone doesn't believe that Danny Rand is Danny Rand because Danny Rand has been dead for 15 years. Then the doctor in the mental hospital says, "Actually, I do believe you're Danny Rand. So, what have you been doing for the last 15 years?" "Oh, yeah, I've been in this mystical city called Kunlun that doesn't actually exist on this plane. It just touches base with Earth every 7 years." Okay, you're not getting out.
Yeah, but if that had occurred in Jessica Jones or Daredevil, there would have been a humorous twist. There would have been, you know, because all of those shows really are about why would you want to live this stupid superhero life when in fact you could work with your friends in this law firm or you can just, you know, you can try and live the life of a normal human being. And there's none of that dimension in this, I found. I mean, Matt enjoyed it more than me, but I think if Iron Fist hasn't got people like me, it's got problems.
Well, I'm going to watch it.
Yeah.
If he's come all the way from the snowy wastes of the Himalayas, which are to New York, then the one film that's more reminiscent of than anything else is Elf.
And I thought you were going to say Coming to America.
And if he merged some of the character traits of Will Ferrell into his existing persona, I'd be rooting for him a lot more.
I would too. Okay, let's have one last bit of music. Michael Hann, what have you brought in for us?
I brought in Farewell Appalachia by Stornoway because Stornoway split up. Oh, they played their final gigs last weekend. I saw them at Shepherd's Bush Empire on Friday night. And it was extraordinary. I've never seen an atmosphere like it at a gig for this gentle, acoustic group of academics playing folk music from Oxford. And the crowd knew every word, sang along to every word, gave huge ovations between every song. The singer was in tears by the end of it. And Stornoway, their group I've followed all the way through. I saw them when they were unsigned, playing in the basement of a pub in London, and wrote about them immediately at that point because I thought they were the best songs of any unsigned group I'd seen. And it's just been one of those things that's just been delightful to watch. So them get more and more popular, not huge, you know, but Shepherd's Bush Empire big. To see them gain that following, to feel that, well, because I was writing about them early, you know, you'd like to, all music journalists, I think they had some part in it. And while they're never going to be hugely fashionable ever, they're one of those groups I think was like a cardigan. You know, you see it in the cupboard and think, that's not very fashionable. But when you put it on, you think, this is delightful. I wish I wore this every day.
Here we go. Well, this is Stornoway. They should split up more often because it's clearly done them a favour. This is Stornoway with Farewell Appalachia. That was Stornoway with Farewell Appalachia, and it's Farewell Big Mouth because we're coming to the end of the show, which means it is time for some closing time chatter, the concerns and obsessions of our guest this week. Peter Perfides, you've got a huge pile of old blues and soul magazines. Tell us what your closing time chatter is.
This is exactly what it is. I bought a job lot of old blues and soul and black music magazines. Those are two separate titles. And on eBay, and they've been giving me a huge amount of pleasure because the one I'm holding at the moment, I brought some of them in, is... these wonderful colour covers, and I've got this one which features the Ronettes in 1973, looking You don't really see the Ronettes in 1973 very much. And just to look through, there you go, there's a fantastic Temptation Centre spread. And to look through these magazines is just to realise how much fantastic information has just not made it online. And even the kind of adverts for kind of soul all-nighters in places that are not Wigan, all over the country. Nantwich Cricket Club, every Sunday, nothing but soul, 7:30 to 11 p.m. A lot of this stuff, most of this stuff, just hasn't made it online. It's not been archived. And it's really, really lovely to be able to... there's Isaac Hayes on the cover there, and there's... that's been my required bedtime reading every night for probably the last 4 or 5 months.
So basically, all copies of Blues and Soul and Black Music are going to rocket on eBay now because you've basically opened up the collector's market.
Well, yeah, but not yet, because there's a few more I need to get, so can you just not start looking until about a week's time?
Fair dues. Michael Hann, what have you got for your closing time chatter?
I brought in a book called Splendour in the Short Grass, The Grover Lewis Reader. I picked this up when I was in Austin interviewing Spoon. He was a Texas journalist. He was one of the new journalists, but probably the least known of them. He wrote about movies, he wrote a bit about music, he wrote about Texas. And I've just read a few of the pieces in here, but they're extraordinary. It reminds you of the days when interviewing someone was not an hour in a hotel room. There's an Allman Brothers piece in here, which is probably the piece he's best known for, which was filed 3 days before Dwayne Allman died and printed 3 days after Dwayne Allman died. And it didn't win him a lot of friends because it's a week in the lives of the Allman Brothers touring America, and they are idiots. They are idiots, their band are idiots, their tour managers are idiots. And there's no editorial commentary. He just reports what they say and do throughout. And you think, what an appalling group of people the Allman Brothers really were.
Oh, I'd love to read that.
Interested only in cocaine and groping flight attendants.
How times have changed.
I know.
In the world of rock and roll. My God.
It's fantastic. It's a reminder of a different time in journalism, a time that I guess all of us who work now wish we could have lived through in some way.
Well, I would love to live through it, apart from the terrible music. I don't have to listen to the Allman Brothers, but if you could do that with Alternate, I would absolutely love
to. No, but you could listen to Pete's Blues and Soul and Black Music Magazine music.
Matt Hall, what have you got for your farewell?
Well, he was mentioned earlier, but Snoop Dogg's got a new track out, and it's a track, actually. The music's by the jazz trio Bad Bad Not Good, who are, I think, Canadian, and they've got a history of working with rappers. They've done a couple of albums with Ghostface Killah, and for a rapper who, you know, is considered by many to have gone down the kind of comedy family entertainer route over the last few years. Played Glastonbury, mid-Saturday afternoon, everyone waved their hands in the air. Snoop Lion, his ill-advised foray into roots reggae. This is an amazing track. It's really hard, it's really menacing, and it's caused a bit of a kerfuffle because halfway through the video, in which everybody is kind of dressed as a clown, in clown face, he shoots a Donald Trump clown figure. The furore in America has been brilliant to watch. The Washington Post starts their news story on it by referring to him as rapper and marijuana enthusiast, which I think is always a good and rather brilliantly, of course, he has been berated in a tweet by Donald Trump, which is
you know what, until you're berated by a tweet by Donald Trump. Excellent. Okay, well, mine's a quick one. My closing time chatter is, all I want to say is I wish I'd copyrighted Landfill Indie, because it seems to be back. There's been two stories referring to Landfill Indie in The Guardian lately, something on Noisy and in Dork magazine. I invented Landfill Indie. Everybody owes me money. Are we actually seeing the rehabilitation of Landfill Indie now?
I was slightly annoyed for not honourable reasons when the Guardian piece on Landfill Indie ran, because I'd been planning to do a special radio show soliciting readers' Landfill Indie guilty pleasures.
Right.
Because I have a few myself. There are a couple of great tracks on the second Hardfire album. That's a perfect instance of the kind of territory I think I'm planning to explore at some point.
America by Razorlight is a tune.
Oh,
wincing there. Yeah. Okay, and on that bombshell, there we have it. That's our show. Thanks to our guest Peter Perfides of The Guardian and Soho Radio, and also thanks to Michael Hann of The Guardian. You're both welcome to come back whenever you like. Remember, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again and all of our archive shows at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth, or you can go to the iTunes Music Store, find podcasts at the bottom of the page, click and search for us, and you can subscribe, which means that you'll not only get the podcast automatically, but you'll get it on Saturday rather than Sunday, so you can beat the enormous rush.
Andrew, I just want to, I'm sure, aren't there some podcast awards coming up?
Actually, you know what, Michael Hamm, there are some podcast awards coming up.
Is it possible to vote for Big Mouth in any of those categories?
I'm glad you reminded me of this. They're the British Podcast Awards. If you go and search for the British Podcast Awards, you'll see that there is a listener's vote in there, and you can enter the Big Mouth and you can vote for us. So remember, vote early, vote often, and we will see you soon. Thanks. Bye-bye.